Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Wally Lamb, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Hour I First Believed, published by HarperCollins. In the weeks to come, we have Sheila Lukens, Michael J. Henry, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tatter Cover, and thank you for supporting your local independent bookstore. Wally Lamb's beautifully written stories of people trying to cope with what life throws at them are both compelling and introspective. And his latest book, The Hour I First Believed, is as breathtaking as his other novels. In this riveting story, and it is riveting, especially here in Littleton, Mr. Lamb explores the consequences of war and violence on human lives in a way that will keep you turning every page. It is a powerful novel full of psychology, family history, and the question of faith in a violent world. Please welcome Wally Lamb.
Well, thank you, Tamara. Appreciate that, and thank you all for being here and sharing your evening with me. I'm certainly happy that you came.
Look at all those people back there. I see you all.
My game plan. I have to kind of watch the time here. But my game plan is to tell you a little bit about myself, read a little bit of an autobiographical essay, who and what I came from, and then read a little bit from the novel. And I would like to. My favorite part is the Q&A. So if people have questions or comments, that would be great. I would appreciate that. This is from an essay that I wrote called Braided Cords. If you say Connecticut, you're likely to conjure in people's minds images of leafy bedroom towns whose Tony residents commute to Manhattan, unwind at the country club, and send their kids off to prep school. But I come from the other Connecticut. I come from east of the Connecticut River, Connecticut, and we're more feisty than fashionable, more liverwurst than pâté. Boston exerts a greater pull on us than New York, and so we drop our R's, root for the Red Sox, and use the word wicked as an adjective, as an adverb. Here's an example. You tatted cover shoppers are all wicked good-looking. Norwich, the eastern Connecticut mill town where I was born and raised, is the prototype for Three Rivers. That's the fictional town where I've now set two of my novels, Dominic and Thomas Birdsey in I Know This Much Is True, and Caleb Quirk, the protagonist of The Hour I First Believed, were classmates as kids, baby boomers raised by their working-class families and by TV, Howdy Doody, Shindig, All in the Family, the news. Each evening after supper, avuncular Walter Cronkite delivered the daily rise and fall, the worrisome advances of communists and cosmonauts, the Elvis and Beatles and hula hoop crazes, the assassination in Dallas, blood spilled in the South for a righteous cause, and in Vietnam for a dubious one. The Birdsey brothers and Caleb Quirk were shaped by turbulent times, the tube, and an Eastern Connecticut sensibility. And so was I. There were no pictures of my paternal grandfather, but I have his pocket watch, a railroad conductor from nearby Noank. He died in his early 30s, the victim of the influenza epidemic of 1918. His young widow was left with an infant son, my father, and no means of subsistence. Grandma took in laundry to survive, and then she got work as a housekeeper for a British gentleman and his two sons. She married the elder son, a factory worker who moonlighted as a banjo player in a radio orchestra. Like the Birdsey twins, my maternal grandparents were Southern Italian immigrants whose families had matched them for marriage. Grandpa was a cobbler, Nana a homemaker who gave birth to 11 children. My mother, number 8, came into the world like her siblings on the kitchen table under the supervision of Auntie, Nana's sister-in-law and her midwife. You know, we never knew Mama was pregnant until Auntie showed up for the delivery, my mother once told me. Ma was timid, devout, funny, and unfailingly kind. Like many raised in the Sicilian tradition, she wanted her children to remain in the fold when they came of age, kept safe from a world that could be hard-hearted and dangerous. "You know, this is good, but don't get too smart," she once advised me as she stared worriedly at a row of A's on my grammar school report card. "It's not good to be too smart." She herself was bright and had wanted to go to college to become a teacher. Nothing doing, her old world father told her. Daughters did not need higher education. They needed to help their mothers with the housework until they had a husband and a house of their own. Grandpa invited himself along on my parents' first date. He sat up in front with his future son-in-law. His daughter rode in the back. When Daddy entered the shoe shop to ask for my mother's hand, Grandpa gave him his blessing and a $20 bill to be spent on groceries. Now, this was a ringing endorsement given the importance of food to Southern Italians. At the time, Daddy worked as a dyer in the woolen mill, and shortly after the wedding, the factory boss offered him a foreman's position, and he wanted to accept it, but it would have meant relocating to the state of Maine. "Oh, I don't think so," my mother told him. She said she couldn't live that far away from her family. And so my father quit the mill and took a job shoveling coal at the utilities department and half of his factory pay. But if there was sacrifice on his part, there was reward as well. Having prioritized familia above career advancement, my father, a self-described swamp Yankee with only a skeleton crew of blood relatives himself, was brought into the fold of his wife's large and loving clan. Through the years, he rose through the ranks at the utilities company, and he retired as a superintendent. He never really liked to be the boss, though, but he sure liked to make people laugh. He was a great storyteller, a raconteur with a million poems, limericks, ditties, and jokes in his repertoire, many of them inappropriate. "Hey, did you ever hear the one about the woman who refused to wear underpants? She went to confession, and for her penance, the priest gave her 3 Our Fathers, 3 Hail Marys, and 5 cartwheels." And I kid you not, I once walked in to my father's nursing home. It was a Catholic nursing home where the nurses were nuns in habits. I heard him tell that particular joke to Sister Gertrude. He loved to sing, my father, "Rock-a-bye your baby with a Dixie melody, and when the saints go marching in." Those were 2 of his favorites. "Daddy, stop," I used to say, clapping my hands to my ears and running from the room whenever his crooning began. Now I wish I could hear him sing again. We lived on McKinley Avenue, a 5-minute walk from downtown, or as Norwichites used to call it, down city. Now, the 4 horsewomen of the apocalypse galloped thunderously through my formative years, and by this I mean not conquest, slaughter, famine, and death, but Vita, Gail, Sandy, and April, my bossy older sisters, and the bossy girl cousins who lived just 2 doors down. Now, the only other boy on McKinley Avenue, Vito Signorino, used to throw rocks at me, and so that left me by default in the relatively safe clutches of Vita, Gail, Sandy, and April, and here I refer to physical, not necessarily psychological safety. My sisters and cousins favored imaginative play over sports and games. More often than not, I was the outside observer of their strange and exotic recreations, but occasionally I would be recruited for one of the girls' games of pretend, cast usually in the role of victim. In a hospital, for instance, they were nurses who got to vaccinate me with straight pins from my mother's sewing box. For a game called Death Drums, they fashioned sarongs out of old dining room curtains and, as Amazons, locked me in the existential darkness of our grandmother's canning closet. And beating on the skin of our Uncle Joe's conga drum, they chanted with mounting hysteria, "Death Drums, Death Drums." I tell you, it's a memory that gives me the shakes 50 years later. Anyway, inching toward puberty and inspired by a bolt of pink net fabric that had somehow found its way into our house, the 4 horsewomen invented a naughty game, and they called it Kingy Boy. And I was Kingy Boy. a 7-year-old Sultan who was required only to sit cross-legged on the floor with a towel wrapped around my head, turban style, while my sisters and cousins, harem girls wrapped in yards of pink net, danced and undulated around me, chanting, "Kingy boy, oh, kingy boy." But when the game was over, I was warned not to tell Ma about it. And so instead, on my very first trip to the confessional, in preparation for my first communion, I spilled the beans to Father Ziegler. "Bless me, Father, for I have sinned. It has been 0 weeks since my last confession. These are my sins. I told 3 fibs. I called my sister a stupid snot. And I played kingy boy." Father's shadow shifted behind the screen. "Well, all right then. For your penance, I want you to say 2 Our Fathers and 3 Hail Marys. Now, let me hear you make a good act of, you played what?" Upon graduation from high school in 1968, I left Norwich and enrolled just 20 miles up the road at the University of Connecticut. The 4 years that I spent there were turbulent and seductive ones, an era in which world politics and cultural sea changes invited baby boomers like me to fight for social justice and party hardy. The sexual revolution had arrived, and marijuana smoke perfumed the dorm. The Vietnam War and the civil rights battle intensified, and the soundtrack of those years segued from "This is the dawning of the age of Aquarius" to "By the time we got to Woodstock, we were 500,000 strong" to "Tin Soldiers and Nixon coming, we're finally on our own." Prepare ourselves for the real world? Hey, shit, man, we were going to fix it up. "I'm on strike," I told my father over the phone after the invasion of Cambodia and the killings at Kent State. "The hell you are," he shouted back into the receiver. "You get to class." But Richard Nixon and Walter Lamb Sr. were more or less interchangeable that season, and so I hung up the phone, stuck my fist in the air, and joined the protest. Now, at the end of that wild 4-year ride at UConn, I did not launch myself into the chaotic world at large. My mother's son, I took a U-turn and returned to Norwich to teach English at the high school from which I'd graduated. Now, my first classes were the ones that no other teacher wanted, comprised of students who had stayed back so many times that about half of them were my age, 21. You're a great group, thank you. The sweat hogs, they were fond of calling themselves. My plan was to win them over by releasing them from the prison that school had been until my arrival. And the sweat hogs and I honeymooned for about a week until the day that I approached Seth Jinks. He was a surly senior, and I asked him to take his head off the desk and pay attention. Now, Seth worked nights, and so he came to school to sleep. He raised his head, as I had asked, and opened his bloodshot eyes and said, "Why don't you go fuck yourself?" Well, the class and I held our collective breath. I had no idea how to respond. But mercifully, Seth unfolded his long legs, stood and ambled voluntarily out the door and up to the principal's office, thereby saving my teaching career. And so I remained at that school for the next 25 years. And I became a pretty good teacher, and I was a good and dutiful son. I visited my parents often, attended family picnics. I served as a pallbearer at all those aunts and uncles' funerals. And along the way, I fell in love with and married a pretty local girl of Italian and Portuguese and Polish blood. Christine is today my bride of 30 years, and we have 3 sons. When I count my blessings, they're at the top of the list. Now, I was 30 when I wrote my first short story, and I've been writing fiction now for about 27 years. In 1992, the phone rang, and the caller on the other end claimed that she was Oprah Winfrey. "Yeah, right," I remember thinking. "You're Oprah Winfrey, and I'm Geraldo Rivera." But it really was Oprah calling to thank me for having written my then just first published novel, She's Come Undone. "I couldn't stop reading it," she said. "You owe me 2 nights' sleep." She called me again in 1997 to say that she had started a new feature on her book club, on her show, to promote the pleasures and the challenges of reading. And so She's Come Undone became the 3rd title of the Oprah Book Club. the following year, I Know This Much Is True became an Oprah Book Club selection too. And these endorsements of my work have been both a boon and a blessing, and Oprah's philosophy to take what you need and pass the rest on to others, well, that's guided me too. And as I've received, I've tried to give back as generously as I can. And that resolution led me to my volunteer work at the York Correctional Institute, which is Connecticut's maximum security women's prison. And I'm happy to say that to date, my writing students there have published two collections of their autobiographical essays, both with HarperCollins, Couldn't Keep It to Myself in 2003, and I'll Fly Away, which was published last year. In his wondrous memoir, Growing Up, Russell Baker writes, "We all come from the past, and children ought to know what it was that went into their making, to know that life is a braided cord of humanity stretching up from time long gone, and that it cannot be defined by the span of a single journey from diaper to shroud. I am, when I write fiction, people other than myself. And many times each week, I'm not just the 58-year-old novelist I turned out to be, but also all the other selves that I have been. The novice teacher, the student protester in tie-dye and love beads, the new father witnessing a delivery room miracle, and of course, Kingy Boy. But I am also, as Russell Baker suggests, all who have come before me. I was born before my father, and my sons were born before I was. The product of a specific time and a specific place, each of us in this store tonight is so much more than that. And that's a lesson I relearn daily when I face the blank page and the glowing monitor of the computer. And it's a lesson that I put into very good use while I was writing The Hour I First Believed. Now, I had a terrible time starting that book, and I could go on and on and on about the challenges of it. But I may talk to you a little bit about that, and particularly about the Columbine connection to that a little bit later during the Q&A. But right now, I thought what I would like to do is read a little bit from the novel. Excuse me for a minute. I'm going to read a couple of shorter sections and then a little longer section from my main character's childhood voice, 8-year-old Caleb. But as the novel opens, he's 47 years old, and he's looking back post-Columbine on that tragic day that changed his life, and more specifically, the life of his wife. He says this in the opening paragraphs. They were both working their final shift at Blackjack Pizza that night, although nobody but the two of them realized it was that. Given this much, they were talented secret keepers, patient planners. They had been planning it for a year, hiding their intentions in plain sight on paper, on videotape, over the internet. In their junior year, one had written in the other's yearbook, "God, I can't wait until they die. I can taste the blood now." And the other had answered, "Killing enemies, blowing up stuff, killing cops. My wrath will be godlike. My wrath will be godlike." Maybe that's a clue. Maybe their ability to dupe everyone was their justification. If we could all be fooled, then we were all fools. They were therefore superior, chaos theirs to inflict. But I don't know. I'm just one more chaos theorist, as lost in the maze as everyone else. Caleb is a teacher at Columbine, and his wife Maureen is a nurse there in the health center. And she takes under her wing a very troubled young woman named Velvet, who has more or less adopted Maureen. And Maureen is in the library that day helping Velvet reapply for school. She's dropped out for a little bit, and she's in the process of coming back to the school. And Calum is back east. His aunt has had a stroke, and he's gone to tend to her. And Maureen excuses herself and says, I just want to call my husband to see how he's doing. And she goes into the librarian's break room and hears, while she's on the phone, she hears the first of the explosions. And she assumes that it's something that's happened in the chemistry lab down the hall from the library, and then realizes after that that Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold have gone on this rampage. And so she hides in a break room cabinet, and she survives, but she's damaged by it. And one of the things that became very, very interesting to me was how the collaterally damaged survive a tragedy such as this. This is Calum after Columbine, as Maureen is beginning to struggle with post-traumatic stress disorder. My pattern was to get her up to bed first and then come downstairs, pour myself a couple of inches of scotch, and go online, cyber search for an hour or two, often longer, sometimes much longer. Occasionally I'd be on that thing until the sun came up. On the night I downloaded the Rampart Ridge video, I watched it twice and then got up and went outside and stared up at the indifferent moon and the clouds drifting in front of it. I stared for a while at the halogen glow from the women's prison next door. I recalled the sight of my Aunt Lolly in her uniform walking down Bride Lake Road on her way to work, that purposeful gait of hers, her arms swinging at her sides. She had been the most reliable person of my whole life, just about the only reliable person, and once again I felt the sharp pang of having lost her at the point when I needed her most. And then I went back inside and poured myself another drink and Googled chaos theory and got 15 million hits. I clicked on the random one and scrolled down. Explosive bifurcation is the sudden transition that wrenches the system out of one order and into another. Well, they had that right. There was our life before April the 20th and our life after it. I Googled chaos theory Harris Klebold and got nothing. Googled chaos theory Colorado State and got the curriculum vita and the university office number of Mickey Schmidt, that nutcase of a seatmate on the flight that brought the two of us out of the Rockies to the east, me to my dying aunt and Mickey to Aquanic Moon Casino, where he planned to beat the house by applying chaos complexity theory. Maybe Mickey could guide me through the explosive bifurcation of it all, point me in some direction that might lead us out of the maze. It was December 31st, 1999, somewhere after 11 p.m. Y2K was upon us, and it was semester break besides. College professors would be away from their offices for weeks. I picked up the phone and called him anyway, and guess what? He answered. "Who did you say this was?" "Calum Quirk. The guy on the plane. We talked about chaos theory. You said you were writing a book for gamblers." He told me he thought that I had gotten the wrong guy. "No, I didn't, man. Your picture is on the faculty website. Look," he said, "I'm busy and you're drunk. You told me you were afraid to fly. I said you asked me to hold your hand during takeoff. And did you?" "Well, no," he said, "you didn't. You had me grip the armrest instead. You couldn't even do that one thing for me." He hung up before I could get my questions about Columbine answered. And so, in the waning minutes of the 20th century, I finished my drink and poured another, shut down the computer, rested my cheek against the keyboard, and started sobbing like a baby. I cried so loudly that it woke her up, and she came down the stairs and sat down next to me and touched my cheek, stroked it over and over. "Everything's all right," she lied. The overhead light shone on her bald patches. The pajamas she wore night and day were stained with food, missing a button. "No, it's not all right," I said. "I'm going to get better, Calum," she said. "I am. I will. I promise." And by the time I stopped crying, it was January, a new year, a new century. Outside, the snow was filling up our fallow fields. Well, that's adult Calum, and this is 8-year-old Calum. You'll bear with me. I'll see if I can find it here. This is a compressed version of the fourth chapter of the novel, and it has, I read it because it has a sort of a beginning and a middle and an end to it. So picture me as a third grader. Sometimes my scary dreams are about Daddy, and sometimes they're about Mr. Zadzilko. Our school used to have a different janitor, Mr. Mapipi, and he got fired. And I was mad because Mr. Mapipi was nice. The teachers think Mr. Zadzilko's nice, too, because he brings them these stupid donut things that his mother makes called punchkis. Mr. Zadzilko's not nice, though. When the teachers go to the toilet, he peeks at them through his secret hole. Before Mr. Mapipi got fired, he came out to our class once, and he told us about these people called the Bushmen that are his relatives or his ancestors or something, and he showed us where they live on the world map, in Africa, near the bottom. And you know what Bushmen eat? Jackals and desert rats. And when they see a praying mantis, they think it's God. Mr. Mapipi had our class all sit on the floor, even Miss Hogan, and us kids sat cross-legged. But Miss Hogan knelt on her knees, and her skirt made a big circle around her. And Mr. Mapipi told us a story about how Mantis made the moon by throwing fire into the night sky, and how he married a snake. And he talked Bushman talk with these little clicky noises before the words. And everybody was laughing, even Miss Hogan. And Mr. Mapipi laughed, too, his high, squealy laugh. Mr. Mapipi is colored, I think, except he doesn't have a chocolate skin. It's more orangey, like the dried apricots that Grandpa eats. After his visit, our class wrote Mr. Mapipi a thank you letter on big easel paper, and we all signed it, and made him so happy that he gave us a present, a praying mantis egg case, and it was supposed to hatch in April, only it didn't. And then after the assembly, Mr. Mapipi got fired. Miss Hogan was going to throw out the egg case, but I asked her if I could have it, and she said yes, and so I brought it home and put it on my windowsill. I caught Mr. Zadzilko peeking. That's how come I know about the hole. It's in the big second floor closet where the buckets and the mops and the spick and span are. And Miss Hogan wrote me a pass and sent me down to help him because I was the first one done with my social studies questions and I had ants in my pants and I kept bothering my neighbors. I opened the closet door and Mr. Zadzilko was peeking through the hole. And he jumped when he saw me and fixed his pants and he was laughing like, oh, look at this. The mop handle must have poked a hole in the wall. Jesus, I gotta patch this when I get a free minute. And he gave me a sponge and told me to wet it in the boys' room and go downstairs and wipe the cafeteria tables. And after, when the recess bell rang, I went back upstairs to return my sponge. And Mr. Zadzilko wasn't there, so I turned a bucket upside down and climbed up, and I looked through the hole. And there was the principal, Miss Anderson, and she was sitting on the toilet smoking a cigarette. And you could see her girdle. I knew it was naughty to look, and so I closed my eyes, and I got down off the bucket, and when I turned toward the door, Mr. Zadzilko was standing there. Well, my, 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 he said, aren't you the dirty little boy? And he yanked the pull chain, and the closet light went on, and then he pulled the door closed behind him and came over and sat down on the bucket so that he was whispering right in my face. The hole was a secret between him and me, he said, and if I said anything, he was going to tell the teachers that he caught me looking. Hey, you were just curious, he said. I understand, but they won't. They'll probably have you arrested, and everyone will know that you're the dirty boy. He reached behind him, and he took a greasy bag off the shelf and opened it and held it out for me. Here, he said, help yourself. And I reached in and pulled out one of those donut things that his mother makes. They're called punchkis, he said. Take a bite. They're delicious. And I didn't want to, but I did. What are you, a little mouse nibbling on a crumb? Come on, take a big bite. And so I did, and the stuff inside looked like bloody nose. What kind did you get? Oh, raspberry, huh? Yeah, that's my favorite, too. What are you shaking for, dirty boy? And I tried to stop shaking, only I couldn't, because he kept looking at me. You know what punchki means, don't you, in Polish? I shook my head. Well, it means little package, because the donut makes a little package around the stuff that's inside of it, you see? I shook my head. Well, can I go now? I said. It's recess. You know, like us men carry the stuff that's inside of us. You get it? In our sacks? I didn't know what he was talking about, but I nodded. Well, you don't look like you get it. Point to where your punchki's at. What? Your little package. Where is it, dirty boy? You point to it. I could hear kids playing outside, but they sounded farther away than just the playground, and I was trying not to cry. And Mr. Zadzilko made an O with his thumb and his pointing finger. Here's the woman's hole, you see, otherwise known as her snatch. And he leaned closer, and he dropped his hand down, and this, my dirty boy, is where your little package is. And he flicked his finger hard, and it hurt. It's recess, I said. I'm supposed to go. Well, go then, he said. But you just remember what happens to dirty boys who can't keep their secrets. The hallway was empty, and there was laughing coming out of the teacher's room, and I went downstairs to the boys' room. I hadn't swallowed that bite he made me take. I hit it against my cheek, and so I spit it into the toilet, and I threw the rest of my poochki in after it, and I kept flushing, and it kept swirling around and looking like it was going to go down, and then it would bob back up again. And by the time I got out to the playground, I had a stomach ache, and then the recess bell rang 2 seconds later, and we all had to go in. And that night, I was lying in bed thinking about Mr. Zadzilko, and Mother came into my room in the dark. Caleb, she said, are you asleep or awake? I didn't answer for a long time, and then I finally said, awake. I heard you crying. What were you crying about? And I almost told her, but then I didn't. Oh, I was thinking about Jesus dying on the cross, I said, and it made me sad. I knew Mother would like that answer. She goes to Mass every morning before work, and that's why she can't get me ready for school. Aunt Lolly gets me ready once she finishes milking, except if there's a problem, she calls me from the barn phone, and I have to get myself ready and not dawdle, or else I'll miss the bus. And one time, some of our cows got loose and started running up Bride Lake Road, and Aunt Lolly had to go get them because they could have got hit by a car, and she forgot to call me, and I started watching Captain Kangaroo, which I'm not supposed to watch TV in the morning, and then the bus came, and I was still in my pajamas. And Mother had to leave work and drive back to the farm and drive me to school. And she was crying and yelling because now Mr. McCulley probably was not going to pick her to be head teller, thanks to me. And at the stop signs and the red lights, she kept reaching over and whacking me. And by the time we got to school, we were both crying. And I had to roll down the window and air out my eyes before I could go in because the school does not need to know about our private family business. On Saturdays, Mother vacuum cleans the priest's house for free and takes home their dirty clothes and pillowcases because Monsignor Guglielmo is helping her get annulled. After Sunday dinner, Mother irons the priest's clean clothes and she drives him back. And if she finishes in time, then we can go to the movies. My favorite movie is Old Yeller, except for that part where Travis has to shoot Old Yeller because he gets hydrophobia. And Mother's favorite movie is The Song of Bernadette. She says Jesus sends messages to the boys that he picks to become priests, and that I should always look and listen for signs. What kind of signs? I said. Well, it could be anything. Could be a voice, a vision in the sky. One time, I saw a cloud that looked like a man with a big Jimmy Durante nose. When I sing Inka Dinka Doo with my Jimmy Durante voice, the grown-ups always laugh. And at the end, I go, good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. And they clap and tell me, do it again, do it again. But Mother never laughs. She says that Jimmy Durante cloud was not a sign from Jesus. I told Mother that the Bushmen think God is a praying mantis, and she said, well, that was just plain silly. Miss Hogan at my school, she used to be our second grade teacher, and now she's our third grade teacher on account of she switched grades. And I'm glad because Miss Hogan is nice. Plus, she's pretty. She drives a green Studebaker, and she likes cats instead of dogs. I mean, I like her, but I don't love her or anything. Miss Hogan's fiancé, Mr. Foster, used to play football at Fordham University, and now he's a cameraman at a television studio in New York City. And Miss Hogan's favorite TV show is I've Got a Secret, because that's the show where Mr. Foster works at. Oh, and you know what? When Mr. Foster visited us that time, Rhonda Bunst raised her hand and said, can you and Miss Hogan kiss for us? And she had to go stand in the cloakroom until recess. Now, one time, during vacation week, Mother let me stay up late and watch I've Got a Secret. And one man's secret was that he got struck by lightning and didn't die. And another man had this long, long beard, and his secret was that at night he slept with his whiskers inside the covers, not outside. And they guessed the whisker guy, but not the lightning guy. Oh, and last year, one of our best milkers got struck by lightning. Dolly, her name is. And you know what the vet said? He said Dolly's heart exploded, and Grandpa had to bulldoze her across the road and down into the gravel pit. And all week long, vultures kept flying over our fields. I've got a secret. Somebody in our grade keeps spitting in the drinking fountain in the main hallway, and Miss Hogan thinks it's Thomas Birdsey, but it's not. It's me. Last week, our whole class was not allowed to get a drink until someone admitted they were the spitter. And everyone got madder and madder at Thomas because he would not admit it. And even I was mad at him because I was thirsty and I kind of forgot who the real secret spitter was. And then Thomas made a load in his pants the way he used to in first grade, and the office made his mother come and get him. And our whole classroom stunk. And Miss Hogan had to send for Mr. Zadzilko, and we all went outside and played dodgeball. And then after, when we came back in the building, Miss Hogan let us all get drinks. In the hallway, Mr. Zadzilko is always looking at me, and I want to say, "What are you looking at, Mr. Big Fat Glasses Face?" I don't, though. I just look away. Sometimes when I try to hand in my paper early, Miss Hogan goes, "It's not a race, Calum. You go back to your desk and check your work." And if I check my work and I'm still waiting and waiting and distracting all the other kids, that's when I have to take the pass and go help Mr. Zadzilko. After Mr. McCulley picked mother-to-be head teller, now she always has to stay late at the bank because of her extra responsibilities. And she won't let me go on the bus because Aunt Lolly is already working at the prison and Grandpa's getting ready for milking. But mother doesn't pick me up until way, way after all the other kids go home. And she had a talk with Miss Anderson about letting me stay and wait. And Miss Anderson lets me because mother is divorced. Sometimes I get to stay in our room with Miss Hogan, and sometimes I have to go and be Mr. Zadzilko's helper. He has me clap erasers or empty the wastebasket into the big barrel in the hallway or wipe down the blackboards with the sponge. And one time, after an assembly, I had to go to the auditorium and help him fold all the folding chairs. And we stacked them on these flat carts that have wheels. And you know where all the folding chairs go? Right under the stage. This door I never even noticed before opens, and the chairs roll in on the carts, and they just stay there until the next assembly. After the United Nations Assembly was when Mr. Mapipi got fired, after he did his dance. First, Miss Anderson gave a speech about the UN, and then the fourth graders sang Around the World in 80 Days. And then some lady who went on a trip to China showed us her China slides, and Anthony Chiangi started tickling me, and Miss Hogan made us sit between her and Miss Anderson. And the China lady talked so long that the projector melted one of her slides, and the sixth graders started clapping. Mr. Mapipi came on near the end, and he walked out on the stage, and instead of his janitor clothes, he was wearing this big red cape and no shoes. And he told everyone how the Bushmen hunted jackals and prayed to their praying mantis god, and he talked that clicky talk, and the sixth graders started being real rude. It's okay if you laugh with somebody, but it's not if you laugh at them. And Mr. Mapipi thought that everyone was laughing with him, so he started laughing too, that high, squealy laugh of his, and it made things worse. And Miss Anderson had to stand up and give the sixth graders a wicked, dirty look. Mr. Mapipi said he was going to show us two Bushmen dances, the dance of the great hungering and the dance of love. But he was not going to stop in between, he said. One dance was just going to turn into the other. "Because what does all of us hunger for?" he asked. And nobody said anything. And so Mr. Mapipi waited, and then finally he said, "We hunger for love." He untied his cape, and it dropped on the floor, and all he was wearing was this kind of diaper thing. I saw Miss Anderson and Miss Hogan look at each other, and Miss Anderson said, "Good God in heaven." Mr. Mapipi was shouting and yipping and doing this weird shaky dance, and he had a pot belly and a big behind, and the sixth graders were laughing so hard they were falling off their chairs. And then somebody yelled, "Shake it, Sambo," and Mr. Mapipi kept dancing, but Miss Anderson walked over and started flicking the auditorium lights on and off, and then she went up on the stage and handed Mr. Mapipi his cape and said that the assembly was over. And then she made an announcement: "Everyone except the sixth graders should proceed in an orderly fashion back to their rooms." And later, during silent reading, Miss Hogan had me bring a note down to Miss Anderson's office, and her door was closed, but I could hear Mr. Mapipi in there, and he was saying, "But why I'm fired, Mrs. Principal? Please say the why." When the teachers are around, Mr. Zadzilko is all nice to me, and he calls me his best helper and stuff, but when it's just me and him, he keeps calling me Dirty Boy. That's to remind you that if you ever blab about certain things, I'm going to tell everybody that the little dirty boy likes to look at his teacher's you-know-whats, and I think that means their girdles. One time I had a scary dream that Daddy was giving me a ride in a helicopter, and we were flying over our farm, and he said, "Hang on, something's wrong, we're going to crash." And then I woke up, and in this other scary dream I had, Mr. Zadzilko grabbed me, and he put me in that dark space under the stage where the folding chairs go, and he locked that little door, and nobody knew I was in there, and I tried to scream, and nothing came out. He told me he killed a dog once by tying a rope around the dog's neck and throwing the other end over a tree branch and yanking. "You ought to have seen the way that dog was dancing," he said. "You got a dog, don't you, dirty boy?" I said, "No, I didn't." "Yeah, you do. He's brown and white. I saw him that time that my mother and me drove out to your farm for cider. I guess maybe if Dirty Boy tells certain secrets, his dog might have to get the Stan Zadzilko rope treatment." And then last week, Miss Hogan made an announcement. "We have to be extra tidy for the next several days," she said. "Poor Mr. Zadzilko's mother passed away over the weekend, and he's going to be absent all week." She passed around a card and said we should sign it in cursive and in pen, not pencil, and as neat as possible. And when the card got to me, I wrote Calum Quirk, but Mr. Glass's face probably doesn't even know my name. And all day I kept thinking about Mr. Zadzilko not being at school. And after school, after I emptied our wastebasket and washed our board and was still waiting for Mother to come, I went up to Miss Hogan's desk. "What is it, Calum?" she said. "I've got a secret." "Oh, you do, do you? Well, would you like to tell me what it is?" "Okay. Miss Anderson smokes. When she sits on the toilet, I seen her from Mr. Zadzilko's peeking hole. Well, for a long time, she just looked at me, like I said it in Chinese or something. And then she got up and took my hand and had me show her. And you know what? The next morning when I woke up, the egg case on my windowsill had hatched. And there were these teeny tiny little praying mantises. And they were scrambling all over the place, on the sill, on the floor, even in my bed. Hundreds of them. Thousands. Millions, maybe. Thanks.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for Sheila Lukens, Michael J. Henry, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on December 1st, 2008.